enemies. Oh yeah, you mentioned David Bowie. Someone wrote.
Yeah, you sent us an email about him and how he's responsible for the financial crisis.
Yeah.
That was good.
Yeah, back in '97, he did the first security float or something.
That's right. Yeah. The culture is our business or whatever.
Well, you know, he hangs out in Switzerland, probably hangs out with turning taxes. Oh, just a minute. Carol's doing something. Okay. You're Carol last?
Yeah.
Is it three horsepower? Is it three horsepower? She's got a three horsepower blender that's bigger than some motorboat.
Wow.
Motors. Okay, so, Dave Bowie probably met Turnin' Taxes through Mick Jagger, because Turnin' Taxes was Jagger's manager, and that's the old European Antichrist, so... Maybe he was working for Turnin' Taxes or got the idea from Turnin' Taxes, the crash of the dollar.
Well, Bowie's apparently the richest pop star, right?
Really?
Wow.
Yeah, like literally, because I think in part because of that, because he put his, I think he put all his catalog on the market, basically.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize that element of it, that he, you know, did that thing where he could reap the rewards instantly,
right?
For future sales or however that works.
And then he must have invested it.
I think he's ranked even. I think Forbes or someone did a list of it, and I think he came out even ahead of Paul McCartney.
Well, who are they?
Phenomenal.
Mm-hmm. Beg your pardon?
Which is pretty phenomenal.
Who are the contenders?
I'm not taxing my memory, but I think I know it was Bowie and McCartney were. I think they were one and two. Madonna was right up there, obviously. Michael Jackson, that was when he was still around.
Yeah.
So he was definitely up there. Although, I think at the time, it was like his worth was very much in question because, you know, of all the stuff he had to sink money into.
Right. What about Yoko Ono?
You know, I can't remember if she was in there, but she must have been.
Yeah.
Because of her inheritance from John?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, she must be in there.
Because I heard... go ahead. I want to interject something.
There were some surprising people, but I'd have to think of it. I mean, I don't know if they listed, like, producers and stuff, and some producers and songwriters would be right up there. They might have just been listing artists that most of the public were familiar with, though.
Right. There may be David Geffen, someone like that.
Yeah. David Geffen and... you know, there's even, I think maybe even some hip-hop producers were pretty way up there because they've produced so many hits in the last 10, 15 years.
You mean Russell Simmons?
Yeah, well, Russell Simmons, I think, definitely. I mean, he shows up on Forbes lists even that have nothing to do with music.
Right. So, you know, he...
Dr. Dre and people like that.
So Russell Simmons, I think he started Fat Farm. The clothing store or whatever it was?
Oh yeah, that's right. He's definitely got his own clothing sort of lines and stuff.
Well, maybe I'll just check it on Wiki, but he started Fat Farm in 1992, and that's when I composed, in January, when Fatty Communion came out. And so it was like a merger of highbrow art and lowbrow art. He was a lowbrow and I was a highbrow. And they both came up with the same term. And I didn't know this till I was in New York by August 93, and one day I was on the subway, and I saw somebody with a T-shirt. It said Fat Farm, and I'm looking at the P-H-A-T. She said, what's that? And so I made a note of it. And then around that time, someone did an article on teen slang and how they were saying the word fat everywhere.
Right.
To mean groovy for the 60s, groovy, it became fat. So
right.
I said, wow.
P-H-A-T,
yeah, so then they were all saying this fat, and I said, oh, that's what Fat Farm is, but I don't know which is the chicken or the egg. But that, to me, I thought, well, there I am, tuned into the Android meme, you know, just perfect. I mean, none of those people knew, you know, they got Fat Farm, Russell Simmons is going to be the mogul of it all, and he begins with the word fat, and right at that time, is when, in highbrow culture, if you want to call it that, out comes fat at communion. And that's the stuff McClellan used to point out. Like he would say, you have a certain kind of event in the 20s, in the arts, and then it would be the same characteristics would be in pop culture, like maybe the rise of tennis or something. See, that's what he'd do. You look at the highbrow, lowbrow, middlebrow, all the different activities, see what the common feature of them is, and then see if it matches with the main new medium of the day.
Right, right.
Like radio.
Hey, Bob, you keep kind of cutting out for me. I don't know if Scott's getting that, too.
No, I'm not getting you cutting out. I am hearing a little bit of static, but it's not too bad.
Yeah, a little bit of static, too. But once in a while, like, it's, for me, like, there'll be a second to 2 second long cutout, like as if you've got an incoming call or something.
Okay, maybe, I wonder if I should,
Now that might just be for me. It might, if Scott's not hearing it, you know, it might be okay.
Okay, maybe I should use Carol's phone, but I think hers is a bit more worn than mine. Okay, I'm going to, I think I did the Star 70, Star 82, but maybe I didn't. Because I have to block that for any incoming calls that, so I don't notice it, doesn't interrupt.
Okay.
So let me just, but I would have noticed it. So anyways, let's just talk for a while, then we'll see how it goes, and then if it...
See what happens, yeah.
So you wanted to have a State of the Union talk. You have another identity crisis, Scott?
Yeah.
you took your temperature, so I can't do this.
More or less. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm just finding it a bit difficult each week to even now we're doing it every 2 weeks. It's still the same sort of thing.
Yeah, we gave you a break and you said shit.
I know.
You enjoyed the break so much you didn't want to come back. I don't want to come back, Bob. It's too scary up there, the lofty heights of real rock Android meme criticism. It's just too much, and I can't keep up with it. And I look stupid, Bob. I'm not prepared. Well, that's the point. You know, we're not prepared.
I mean, and you know, and I probably don't want to over-prepare kind of thing.
Right. No,
yeah,
not,
I don't know. I probably freak out a little bit, like, come every, like, Sunday or Monday, because I start to think, oh, damn, I got to come up with some material or something.
Yeah, you do.
I got to do some.
But you don't. It never has. Like, this Ben thing, it's always something shows up. They got Ben Watson thing. You might want. Let me give you some reviews. First off, over on Alt Slack, they decided to compare me to Elmert Tilarm. I don't have the exact name. He's a Norwegian or Swedish Elvis impersonator, okay? Have you ever heard of him?
No.
Okay, and you can look him up, and he in the 90s, and he was very... He didn't look like Elvis. He didn't try to look like him. He was an old guy, and he couldn't sing, yet he kept showing up trying to be an Elvis impersonator. And he actually put albums out and got a bit of a fan base, you know, on a satirical level or something. So the Stan guys were saying, you know, Bob Dean, he is Elver Pilarmy is to Elvis, Bob Dean is to the Church of Genius. So they're claiming I'm a lousy impersonator of their Bob Dobbs, right? And so I liked that, and I said, okay, I'm going to correct it, because here's what it really is. I'm the, how's it work, how's it go? Okay, as...
Like, you are to the Church of the Subgenius, Bob, as...
Yeah, that's how you do it? Okay. As Richard Meltzer is to Robert Christgau.
Ah.
And I put in brackets, because I went to Christgau's site just to see how it was spelled, and it was Dean of American Rock Critics. That's what he has on his site. So it,
he calls himself, yeah.
Yeah, so here's the intertwined Bob satire, is that I'm Richard Meltzer to their Richard, their Christgau. They're the Dean, the Bob Dean of American Rock Critics.
Right.
So I love that. I said Richard Meltzer to Robert Christgau in brackets, Dean of American Rock Critics. Okay, so I just wanted to tell you that story. That's pretty neat.
Yeah, that's cool.
And I am the R. Meltzer in terms of I'm the new version because I'm just saying and doing stuff that's incomprehensible like he did 40 years ago. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And taking it.
Take it to another level, and but it does communicate something because, you know, the knowing ones like Jim Patterson, they think this is the greatest stuff, which reminds me, we got an email from Andrew Crystal, another insider. He's the guy in New Zealand who did the PhD on McLuhan.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so he's a teacher at a university. He wrote, slowly we're getting responses, so... Jim Patterson's always been on top of it, and he loves it, but Andrew wrote, he says, have just finished all the Scott Woods sessions. They are great burgers, he puts in quote, burgers. Remember we were talking about this was
yeah.
the burger or something?
Yeah.
They are great, and that was like in the last one, I think.
That's right, it was, yeah.
So he goes, they are great burgers and very stimulating. Particularly the inclusion of Croker from session 6 onwards. You seemed, he says to me, you seemed to allow Scott to be a good interviewer. You get no credit, Scott. I allowed you to be one. Then he says, but no, it's a compliment. You know, you seem to allow Scott to be a good interviewer.
Yeah, that's funny, yeah.
Yeah, and then he says, I would like to hear Ben Watson respond to these sessions. See,
so
now the crowd is saying, bring on Ben. We want Ben. Can
yeah.
Ben take it?
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, I would like to hear Ben Watson respond to these sessions. Well, you know, it's...
Well, he has a little bit, I mean.
So what is Ben Watson? Ben Watson is the... you know, it's the old thing. People say to me, I wish you were Charlie Rose, Bob. You would do the best interviews, you know, on PBS or whatever. So
yeah.
Let's say Ben is we can't get Ben... in a situation where he's not in control, okay? He has to control it, right?
Right.
Okay, so who would that be? If I'm Richard Meltzer, okay, what would... We're the upstarts. It's like if you listen to some of the Ben Watson things, he and his friend Danny Houston in the 70s and 80s were always scheming to get Zappa's attention so he could get into the inner circle, right?
Right.
So Andrew... Crystal is scheming for us to bring Ben / Frank Zappa into the scene here, you know, but he won't step down. So
yeah.
So who is like, who, if we were trying to get, well, it's almost like you wanting to call Meltzer and get Meltzer to listen to this stuff, right? You know,
right.
It's similar to that. Or who else, what's a good metaphor? We're trying to get, what debate never happened? Let's see. We never got LaRouche debating McLuhan. We never got Tim Leary debating LaRouche. See, LaRouche, it's like trying to get LaRouche to get these establishing people to debate LaRouche. That's the thing.
Right,
so
right,
we're trying
yeah.
to get Ben out of his arena and forced to deal with what he would perceive as junior people, you know.
Right.
And that's what Andrew's asking for. I'd like to hear Ben Watson respond to these sessions. And I think Ben listened to something, didn't he?
He mentioned in one of your shows the Meltzer stuff or something.
Yeah, he did. He claimed
Meltzer at one point, saying that, you know, he was in full... you know, fully on side with what Meltzer's saying, which I thought was great. I mean,
right. He claimed to have heard the great Meltzer one where we read a lot of Meltzer stuff, you know.
Right.
And I think that we need to go through that and he should talk about it more because just to say, yeah, I agree, is not dealing with what actually Meltzer wrote and my response to what Meltzer wrote. That's what he's not dealing with. He's not going into the details.
Right.
So, okay, so we have that now. What else? Somebody said that Scott Woods didn't do too well in the last session.
Okay.
And I don't know I think it was too much over your head. They liked what you've been doing up to that point, but for some reason the last session you didn't perform well enough or you weren't prepared or something, which is the one thing you were afraid of being, and I don't think you need to be that prepared. You just need to think about all the things that you want to ask about anything and ask it.
Yeah. Well, see, that kind of gets a bit to the crux of the identity crisis for me, is that I kind of, in some way, it's not so much that I'm, like, I'm worried or I'm intimidated or something like that. It's more just that I kind of don't know where to go right now with this stuff. And part of the reason is because this whole sort of series started out as a sort of a prolonged sort of discussion on rock criticism. And in the while this is simultaneous to this happening, I'm kind of like having this revelation in my life that I need a fucking break from this stuff, like specifically about rock criticism, not Bob stuff, but like the rock criticism stuff. And it's like I find it really hard right now to even go back and sort of revisit and think about some of these people who, like, 3 months ago I was really excited to kind of get your take on stuff. And I mean you've given like a lot already, obviously, on like Meltzer, and you know, we've talked about a few of the people, you know, Chris Galmarcus, whatever. But it's weird. I've gone through this really weird shift. I mean, and for me, it's a big kind of shift, because I've been drowning in this stuff for like 20, 25 years, and it's like a door has opened lately, and it's been like, I don't know why, like, I've just been so fucking obsessed with this stuff for so long. I mean, I feel like I don't want to be part of that particular conversation right now. I'm almost doing anything I can to extricate myself from it, and that involves, right, like, even kind of going back to those texts. And, I mean, it's probably a temporary thing, because it's so in my bloodstream that it's always going to be there. But it's a real weird sort of... So part of it is that I just, you know... Well, where am I going to take this conversation? Because I don't really want to go over like the Kogan articles, which we haven't discussed. And I don't really feel like going further into Chuck Eddy, and you know, we did a bit of the Jeffrey O'Brien or whatever. But it's just
okay.
I like what you're giving me, because it's like it's new criticism, and I'm getting something out of it.
Yeah, that's it.
I don't know how to compare it to the past at this point, because I'm finding it personally kind of drudgerous to bring up all these guys right now.
Okay, so in other words, you're a good student. You're learning what I'm saying. I have something that puts a frame around rock criticism that points to larger things, which then become more interesting than rock criticism. So you're actually getting my point.
Yeah, no, I think so.
Yeah, and it would be interesting to somehow analyze what it was that fascinated you, and I think that's relevant. I think rock criticism is what good minds go into and read, because it's talking about the present and about the repetition. There's nothing, but nobody has the larger language that I got from McLuhan and other places that actually makes it more mature.
Right,
makes
right.
it more mature how to look at this, and then you don't just stay obsessed with rock criticism because you think rock criticism is the only thing that is doing it. And it is the only thing that's writing about your present, but there's another way to write about the present. And that's Dobbstown.
Right, right.
And it's broader. And then the other thing was, we should maybe look at some more Meltzer text. I think someone asked for more Meltzer text.
Oh, yeah? Well, that's a possibility, because, I mean, I think even just of the excerpts I've sent you, I'm certain that I went through and... highlighted a bunch of parts, or you know, marked them, whatever.
Yeah.
So and then I just probably thought after session two and session three, well, maybe we should move on, because you know, we could read this whole book. But then maybe we could read the whole book. You know what I mean? Like it doesn't have to be that.
Yeah, because I think I'm
not sick of it. So why?
Yeah.
You know.
I think someone Jim asked us to go back and do more Meltzer, because Meltzer is whack enough. It's wacky enough that it can point to what I'm talking about, and it's the only stuff that can. It's hard to understand, so it needs to be explained, you know. Or to,
yeah.
So we may, and you know, you've sent me. I can just go find the various things you sent me. A whole bunch of pages. We just bring them up. But the
yeah, and I've got some. I think I'm sure I've got some other quotes highlighted in there too. So.
Right. So the other thing was, somebody said they were impressed with you and the interviews. And they went to your rock critics, and they couldn't believe your top 10 best of decade lists.
Right, right.
For some reason, they said, "What? The guy is like talking about candy." And
yeah.
they they are, I don't know, I've seen your list but not read them. I don't even know what they refer. I don't know what the music is. You know, I don't know
anyone.
Someone
reposted my top 10 list on Five Bodied.
Oh yeah?
Is that guy, I think you call him Ear Map or something. Is he the guy who does all the crazy graphic stuff?
Oh yeah, no, that's Jim Patterson. Yeah, that's it.
Jim Patterson?
Yeah, Jim Patterson is Ear Map on the McLuhan list, and he does Eat That Question on the Five Bodies.
Eat That Question, that's right. First of all, his stuff is phenomenal. Like when he does those collages and
stuff,
great. I mean, I went on the Five Bodied for one of them and kind of complimented him. I thought that's just brilliant. Like that's just graphically like really fun and stuff. But I think I think it was him who posted it. And I thought it was slightly sort of, and it didn't bother me at all, I thought it was slightly cheeky, like, yeah, for the reason you just suggested, almost like, wow, this is like, look at what this guy actually, like, listens to and stuff. This is kind of really funny or whatever. But then it was neat because I was looking at my list being played back to me through Five Bodied, and I'm like, there's a lot of Bob sort of stuff on my list. Like, the first song is called Digital Love. Like, there's just all these kind of weird resonances. I was like, wow, you know what? I'm, like, almost listening to these songs differently, just looking at it on Bob's website.
Oh, that's neat. Yeah, how could I hear any of these or get them?
Well, you could get them all on YouTube.
Oh, okay. So maybe after a while I'll go and look at your top 10 list.
But that's what people don't understand about me, and you know I'm not the only one like this. I mean, there's other critics out there who do this, but it's like I do. I pay attention to, like, Ben Watson would be horrified by my taste in music. Like, he would be absolutely horrified. I mean, if I did a top 10 albums of the decade, I have a Britney Spears album in there. I Dave laughed because I wrote like a really positive review of the Paris Hilton album.
Right, he laughed at that.
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't that surprised because he knows, like, you know, Dave likes a lot of pop music too. Obviously, like we've tried making dance music together and stuff like that. So,
yeah, but here's the thing: I said to this person, maybe it was Jim, that I said that is silly to judge someone's taste. First of all, it's silly to list a bunch of shit. It doesn't matter. List anything, you know. But I wouldn't judge somebody by that because I know I like stuff that, for the moment, it's all transitory, which is what I was saying last session. Going by noting what you like is irrelevant in this information overload environment because you're going to like things for different reasons at different times. So what's it matter? I mean, what anybody likes. I mean, I've liked the bad stuff, which would be, well, you know, I might like Archie Bell and the Drells. One time, I'm in the mood, I'm in a car, and they put that song on, and it's great, you know?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and for me, it's like, it's always been kind of the experience as much as the thing itself.
Yeah.
And pop music, for me, I mean, that's why when Ben, you know, that's why I kind of got my back up a little bit when Ben made that comment about Simon Frith. Not,
right.
Because it's not that I felt protective of Simon Frith per se, but I did feel a little bit protective of what I think Ben was sort of saying that Simon Frith kind of represented, which is like Ben was saying, you know, he's just being fake by saying that he likes all this pop music and he's doing it to be hip and stuff. And it's like, well, Ben, you're basically talking about me, but I don't do it because I think I'm hip. If anything, that makes me completely unhip to be a man in, you know, 45 years old who's actually taking, like, you know, who thinks, like, Britney Spears beats are, like, as good as anyone's out there. I mean, it's just, you know, it's a good flavor right now kind of thing. So, but it's just, I like the transitory nature of pop music. I mean, it's that's what it's fun. I probably like a lot of that stuff more than, you know, I would listen to most of the critically acclaimed stuff. I just find it's supposed to be important and serious, and, you know, it's like,
yeah, and that's what I mean. Okay, so Ben, he moves to grander frameworks, grander value judgments based on who likes what. And I say, no, that's not the way you make a grander framework. You do it the way McLuhan did. You look at the structure, not the content. And that's where it gets weak. If you build your argument on matters of taste, you're a fool because you can't police anybody on the taste level. Everybody likes everything for all kinds of different reasons. The user is the content. But how can you write about it and make a structure out of it, even a hierarchy of value, without going into taste? And that's what McLuhan did, and that's what I'm doing. See?
Yeah.
And so that's, I mean, and then you say, well, why do people, see, this, somehow we could talk about this. Why do people judge you for what you like in a world where there's no monitoring what anybody could like? There's just too much to like or not like. So it's not, so people, see, so Jim values what I'm doing for the structure, but he's still got the judgment of people's taste factor going on in there. And and that's where, that's not really what I'm about.
Yeah.
Like I was trying to say, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say there's actually a good book about this. I mean, it's good. It doesn't even touch on the McLuhan stuff or the Bob stuff at all. But it's this guy from Toronto, Carl Wilson, wrote a book about a Celine Dion album. And it's called Let's Talk About Love. That's the name of the album, actually. It's a part of this series, the 33 and a Third series, where all these people write about albums.
Right. I know Kevin Currier did Beef Art, I think.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
And his whole kind of thesis, I guess, in that book is that, this is a guy who, like, grew up kind of hating and loathing Celine Dion, you know, to the core of his soul kind of thing.
Right.
And then he just decided to, like, well, it's interesting to maybe think about why. So, like, and it's instead of, like, sort of examining it as a guilty pleasure, it's like your guilty unpleasures.
Right. So he evaluated in his book why he didn't like Dion.
Yeah, and just the whole, and it's really a book. The subtitle of the book is A Journey to the End of Taste.
Yeah,
which is a really good pun, actually, because he's, you know, like taste is irrelevant.
But here's the thing, Scott. What I offered, what McLuhan built, and what I offer is how to think beyond the end of taste. See, that's what's interesting.
Yeah. Oops, you cut out again there.
No, okay. Am I there? Yeah.
Yeah, you're there.
Yeah, I was saying that that's what I offer. That's why you need to make a separate file for me in the Rock Race. I'm offering a way beyond the end of taste. Like, this guy gets to the end of taste, and then you just become a passive consumer, like and not like, and you're kind of apathetic or you're kind of enthusiastic, but you're ironic about it. You don't know how to think beyond that. That's what I'm offering.
Yeah.
A way to think about this thing that's, quote, more mature or at least more relevant, and then that's why I can use it and go in and talk to Ben as a Marxist, you know, and go involved with that and bring up these issues in relation to the so-called socialist revolution, you know? See, you can go anywhere with this formula. And the formula, okay, so, and I was trying to say that in the last thing we did, is that I don't care what I like. And if I like some today, I wouldn't point it out because I might not like it in a week.
Yeah,
you know, and people don't want to know that. They want to think that they like something, and that's their goal, and they require the value.
Now, that's the story, and they're sticking to it.
Yeah, so here's an interesting thing. J.W., who channels Ion, you know, he's a Southern guy, grew up in a Christian culture. He saw this Vestal Goodman gospel. And did you see that? Did I send it to you?
Well, no, but I sort of figured it out by the I did hear the last Ben show and saw the email. You did send me the email, but from Ben.
So you haven't heard it.
I haven't heard it though.
Okay, so he tells me later, he thinks I'm a sophisticated, whatever, you know, snobby intellectual or something, though he knows I'm not that or he wouldn't talk to me, but he knows I know nothing about gospel world, you know. I've experienced a few gospel, black gospel on cable TV in New York. And but anyway, so he sent this clip, Vestal Goodman, who he says he was probably conceived to, right?
Right, right.
And his parents. So I watch it, and I am blown away. This is the most amazing singing, and it's a white person, and it's really interesting, and she's got an incredible voice. And then I go on YouTube and find these other things, and I think she's the greatest thing I ever heard of. And if she was singing in my church, I'd go to church every day. You know what I mean?
Is it current music, or...?
I was done, the really good one we're using on the show, on Cashflow, is from 1974. She died in 2003, but the stuff that I sent you is some from the 90s. There's 90s and 1974. Anyways, so I really liked it, and then I called him up, and he couldn't believe that I liked it. He said, I'll just send this, and Bob will just laugh at it. But no, I liked it, and I wanted to know all about her. And then I got a whole lecture for an hour and a half on or a tour, not a lecture, of the whole southern Georgia gospel culture world. And he told me all about these different people, and I went and looked at them on YouTube, and that was really interesting. And I found it incredible. They all bowed down to Vessel Goodman. She was the queen. And J.W. says that white gospel was before black gospel. And that and Vessel Goodman was really the Elvis, the beginning of it all, of the modern gospel. It's a whole different history that we're not qualified to comment on because we didn't grow up in it. And we just know the black gospel, which is, you know, the Aretha Franklin and what she came out of and what R&B came out of. But there was these people back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. So Vessel Goodman comes out of that culture. And you see pictures of her. She's got like a 10-foot high beehive haircut in the 50s. You know what I mean?
Wow.
So anyways, so I get all this interesting stuff from him. So I said, look, from now on, send me any YouTubes you think are interesting. So he sent me a whole bunch, and I went through it. So that was a real lesson. And so then I had what JW was to me, I had to Ben. I'll send this crap Christian shit to Ben and see what happens. I also thought, well, maybe he'll like it because Ben generally likes R&B and all that. So I forwarded you the email, right? Let me just find it. It was a revelation to him, just like it was for me. And, okay, where is it now?
You sent one, The Emotion of Multitude.
Yes. That was
from Ben, I think.
Yeah, no, The Emotion of Multitude. Okay, so I had found a way to post this Vessel Goodman. Rather than just saying, listen to this gospel, I said, okay, I'll take WBH's comment on The Emotion of Multitude and then McLuhan's use of that. And then I said, okay, that's literary emotion multitude. Now, what is Vessel? Okay, she's audible tactile because of her metallic voice. And I was thinking of Ron Rosenbaum's statement about, well, quoting Dylan, saying, Dylan said his voice was metallic and something else. So then the third thing was footage of Haiti earthquake victims, and I said, this is the proprioceptive emotion multitude, proprioception being losing your balance. Proprioception is how you gauge your balance. So you have an earthquake, everybody loses their balance and falls on the ground, and with some news footage, everybody, all the bodies on the ground, right? So it was a proprioceptive emotion multitude. So it was a cheeky probe, but interesting. But it was my way of getting Ben to listen to it. So he writes back, regarding the emotion of multitude, the Vestal Goodman clips are terrific! Terrific! Metallic is the word. Organic mimicry of the hardware is the true moment of multitudinous communion. And that's what we get into discussing on the last show, which you've heard some of it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the last Ben thing. Then he goes, McLuhan's words about theater, he's inveighing against what Brecht would call bourgeois realism, come alive in the context of the Goodman footage, New World Classicism, and in the last Ben thing, I try to get him, well, what those words mean? And he sort of said, well, those aren't really good words, but New World Classicism scores a point. Then he goes, Bob, we could rewrite the book on pop culture and world literature. Now, that is what I've just been saying to you, is that you have this new framework. You can rewrite a lot of stuff, which McLuhan already did, but you can carry it on updating it, and that's how big this framework can be applied to pop culture and world literature. Invent an aesthetics politics that could truly deal with our unsaid senses. Very good phrase, unsaid senses. Trembling on the brink of the virtual global sensorium. Oops, we already are, of course. Talk to you Wednesday. Now, what's neat, yeah, we're doing that, but we got your dialogues as counterpoint to it.
Yeah, that's true.
And so I'm in the tactile interval playing one interview off with the other. But Ben doesn't do that yet, but he wants to do that. So in this thing I sent you, we got talking about it, and he liked the last show when we talked about Vessel Goodman. He says, you know, it's good we talk about objects. He says, we have a third object to talk about, then we don't talk about each other and we don't become objects to each other. So he's all for an object. So I send him the next object, which is this oldies thing, which, have you heard a bit of it? The Noah American DNA, Noah's Ark. Did you?
I saw the link today, but I didn't go through that one yet.
Okay, well, it's a great
something new on Five Bodied or something. You said, right?
Yeah, on Dobson.com, a new feature. And so Scott Norris he found a way to tape it, and because it's this great show, been coming for 40 years out of Fordham University, great, incredible encyclopedia of R&B, and I've been listening to it for 10 years. You know, mainly in New York, but I stopped it over the past year and a half, basically. I wasn't into New York. I wanted to live in Hawaii and be here, but recently I went back, and I said, oh, this is great stuff, and I said, I bet you Ben would like this. So I sent it to Ben, and it opens with a song by the Dells, and not the Drells, the Dells. And he, so I said to Ben, what?
Is it a song called There Is?
No, no, I don't know what it's called. And it's they redid something they did in the 50s. So the Dells are a famous band or something, but I don't know them that well. But it's a great opening of a show broadcast on January 9th. So I just, as a little probe, sent it to Ben. And he writes back, "The Dells in 1969!" Exclamation mark. "It's the key to how Frank did doo-wop in the 80s. What a find! This is a great show! How did you find it?" So I said, well, it's been on the radio for 40 years, but anyways, I don't know what, it's interesting, we're going to go into this. The key to how Frank, not, I mean, he and I, what's he mean, did, the key to how Frank did doo-wop in the 80s, what's that mean? I know he couldn't find band members to do it because they were too young. But maybe he meant the 60s. I'm not sure what Ben meant by that.
Maybe. Well, I think the Dells, I mean, I think they kind of have a definite doo-wop sort of, like...
Oh, I know what he means. The Dells redid their song in 69 from the 50s, and it's so great and sort of modern, more modern, tuned into 69.
Right, right.
That's what he's saying. Frank upgraded doo-wop in the 80s like the Dells did in 69. That's what he meant. Okay, that could be it. So I sent him, so then that inspired me to start saving this guy's show because all this stuff will disappear maybe someday. And so we get Scott to tape. So we're going to start having this every week, each show. Just pile them up because they're incredible, the collectors in the New York area, because they all were near the stuff to buy it, you know.
I'll definitely check those out for sure.
Yeah, definitely listen to the show. So the, what was I saying? Okay, so we'll save it. We'll call it Noah's Ark. And so this will be our next object. So you and I, what we've done is approach the larger framework called Android Meme Rock Criticism. And it gets unwieldy, and it can become purposeless, like, what are we doing it for? And actually, the what are we doing it for is more over on the Ben level, because we're talking on a big level. You and I aren't talking about that. We're talking about objects. That's why I think we should do some Meltzer text, because it's fun. He does approach big frameworks, because he talks about art and politics and pop music, you know what I mean? He's trying to have the big view. So, so what I could do is I could, I'll go to your recent emails. You got the book there.
Yeah.
And find the one where you sent all those.
Well, those ones were specifically, we can go through those. Those ones were specifically with the Zappa reference.
Oh, okay. Actually, let's just go to the notes we have. I got lots of notes here that you sent me, the Xerox. Let's go there.
Yeah, that might be a little...
What?
Yeah. That might be a little better, actually.
Yeah, because it's more samples of
more
the book.
More stuff, yeah.
So I go down to my little drawer, and we pull it out, and we find Aesthetics of Rock, which is the first one, and the first couple. Yeah, Passage in Unknown Tongues. Oh, yeah, there's a whole bunch of stuff here.
One page I was going to ask you if I sent you one. Did I send you, I think I sent you like three or four chapters. Does one of the chapters incorporate page 174?
Okay, I'm looking at, I've got 1 to 21, 112 to... 135, 248.
Okay,
no. No, but wait a minute. There might be another one later. I'll go. Okay. That's because I have them all in order. See if there's any more here that you added. Meltzer. Oh no, number four. Well, that's a reprint. Okay, it's the forward. That's not really what you're talking about.
Okay.
Not that. Okay. The bird is the word. Frank Cogan's review. Let's see. Brief. Gulcher. No.
We should talk about Gulcher at some point too, but I probably need to send you more excerpts from it. That's his follow-up book.
Right, and I have Gulcher.
Really interesting. Oh, you had that one. Oh, yeah, that's right. You have that in your storage, eh?
Yeah, and then Eddie, Bangs, Cogan, Marcus, Jeffrey O'Brien. Let's see. Marcus, Two Chaps Stranded. Richard Meltzer, Vinyl Reckoning. Oh, we did that, Two Rolling Stone. There's no more Meltzer from Aesthetics of Rock.
Okay.
So you didn't send that.
I can still send you some. Or
yeah.
But it just, he's got a really good entire page about cliché, And I thought, well, I'd like you to put that in the framework of
cliched archetype,
and all that. Yeah, and it's like it's pretty interesting. It's kind of a head turner for sure. Like it's he plays a lot with the language, but it's interesting.
Okay, so so I think that we go back to the object. It will always expand to whatever comes out of the conversation, because I'm always thinking about the present anyways. You know, I'm not.
Yeah.
But it is interesting to know, yes, rock criticism is dead. It's obsolete. That's why Chris Gow was fired. It was, you know, the Village Voice trying to figure out, well, whatever, we got to come up with something else. It's just ridiculous. How are you going to write in like you and Scott? You look at the Grammys, it's not music, which is exactly what McLuhan said 50 years ago, that rock teen music, he said, was not music. It was an environment. The environmental or multimedia aspects of it became more prominent beginning with Bowie. And then the more theatrical stuff today with the digital technology. It is a circus. It is not, per se, music. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's approaching tactile. It's trying to be totalistic, include everything. And that was that's where the third phase, from visual art in the 20s to oral art, audio art in the 60s, to tactile art.
Yeah.
And that's a framework to look at this. And then you figure out what audience or what are they trying to say. And usually what they're saying, there's no verbal message that would limit it to the acoustic. So they're not saying anything. So what is the role of it? What is the point? You know, it's more like heroin. Give me a bigger dose. I've had all this stuff. I'm numb. You got to give me a bigger dose. And you got to be outrageous. But there's a limit for the chemical body, because a young kid is growing up working out their sexual identity and all that. In that little chemical body framework is where the tension is, and they think these blasting things are dealing with their dilemma, right? Their intuition, they got more than one body. But for someone like Scott Norris, you know, in his 50s or whatever, you ain't involved with that. It's only for little kids. And there was a great cartoon in The Medium is the Massage where two businessmen, a New Yorker cartoon, are looking at these two young rockers or mod people, and they're saying, they're sort of frowning, yeah, look at them, but they're worth one-third of the economy. You know, the youth market is an important part of the economy. And then the different, you know, you got, 8 to 15, and 15 to 19, then 25 to 35. You see these ratings, demographics for TV, and for that's how they gauge everything, right?
Yeah.
So this is where McLuhan and everybody is saying, the good ones saying, hey, you guys are having a good time, you kids, but you're not going to have a framework and know how to think when you're 35. You won't know how to find meaning beyond what you're being stimulated by now. And that's actually what you're at now. You're not stimulated by that. It's irrelevant. So what are you going to be stimulated by? How are you going to think? That's where Bob's a fucking doctor.
Yeah.
I am offering therapy to give you a framework so you can keep your mind muscle going.
Yeah,
that's what it's all about. That's why Scott Norris is into this Bob stuff, because he doesn't watch the Grammys. He actually goes and he sees it. Oh yeah, that's why I don't watch it. That's what he gets out of it, right? Oh, I forgot. Oh yeah, that's why. It's nothing.
Yeah.
It's not for someone who's 1,000 years old. And when you're 45 or 50, you're 1,000 years old compared to a 20-year-old because of the experience you've had compared to 100 years ago. You know, or lower society. So okay, better stop talking, but. That's I've actually said in the last 20 minutes my basic points, you know, about the taste thing, and that's that. So I'm sure that's said in the show. So let's go back and do an exegesis of as much as we've, in any way. I mean, I'll just look at a paragraph, start reading it, and then get ideas from it.
Turn to a page, yeah, exactly.
Okay, so I'm going to go piss.
So just for my reference, though, Bob, just tell me again, What were the, just specifically of aesthetics of rock, what were the three sections I said, just in terms of page numbers?
Right. The first, the Birds of Word, 1 to 21.
Okay.
Picture of...
Dave Clark 5 or something?
Yeah, yeah. And then the next one's 112, and it's not every page, but it's in the range of 112 to 135.
Okay, that's fine, yeah.
And then 248 to 248 to 258.
258. Okay, perfect.
And then you sent me the forward to the Zacapo edition by Marcus and maybe by him.
Him as well. Yeah, I sent you both of those for sure.
Which is interesting.
Those are both interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, we go through what he says, and I'll point out where he's embarrassed a bit about it, but he knew he said something, but he doesn't really know what he said. He doesn't know how to deal with what he did. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. And I might even want to, if I look through some of this stuff, maybe even bring up a couple of Marcus's points, actually, to see if he's grasping at all what Meltzer was actually trying to do.
That's right. So you know this stuff better than me in terms of instant recall. So we should just start going through the text. And it might be boring to people, but I'm sure it'll...